Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. How you doing, everybody? Welcome back to the podcast. Today's April 8th. Markets are celebrating a temporary ceasefire. We'll see what happens in the Middle East. So that's at least some positive news after a lot of threats on social media, a lot of volatility in the markets. It'd be nice to have some positive days and follow through and durability. That was one of the clients asked me today is, do you believe this is going to be a durable recovery as a result of the ceasefire? You know, we're going to move on to the next worry very, very quickly. So it's very hard to tell any client that any rally is durable. But if you keep the long-term investing mindset, of course, those are the better things to focus on. So today's podcast, we're going to talk a little bit more about the Iran conflict and the volatility that it's caused and our actions through it. And hopefully we're past the worst of it. Please, dear God. We also want to talk a little bit about a new position in the portfolio, FICO, Fair Isaac Company, recently bought for our clients, and we'll talk about the rationale for the purchase. Before we get to that, let's get to this. If you like this podcast, of course, please subscribe to us on Apple, on Spotify, and on YouTube. Please, your five-star reviews, your comments, always positive, help us so much. And we appreciate you checking out Baskin Wealth Management website, checking us out when we're on BNN, doing our hits on TV or any other podcast. We love talking about investments and hope to share more good news going forward with everybody.
Hopefully.
So at least the market for right now, it's what time? It's just after lunch on April 8th. There was this 8 p.m. deadline on April 7th that if U.S. and Iran didn't agree to some kind of ceasefire or end to the war, that all hell would break loose. Luckily, it looks like the two sides agreed to keep on negotiating. So, but obviously, throughout the entirety of March and most of April until now, this is all we can think about.
No, and I think one of the things that has that this whole crisis and situation had led people to realize kind of the interconnected nature and the reliance of so many products on one part of the world.
Right? That's right.
So, for example, like oil and gas is the obvious one. But beyond that, the amount of fertilizer that goes through the Strait of Hormuz, the amount of helium.
No one ever thought of this
right.
In February of 2026, right?
Right. Yeah. The amount of helium that is produced in that region and is used not just for balloons, but for MRI machines, right?
Yeah, MRI machines, even helping making these AI chips and memory chips, yeah.
And then like the sulfur that is produced there, that is used to refine nickel, for instance, right? And so all of these things are being impacted by the conflict. And I think following when this is resolved, hopefully soon, I think there's going to be an effort on the part of everybody to be finding alternative suppliers, and I think Canada will be a beneficiary of that.
By the way, Ernest, do you know how slow these million barrel oil tankers move through the ocean?
Yeah.
Like 20 miles an hour at best, right? And so it takes them forever.
Yeah,
to get to their destination. So hopefully the log jam, I guess, that they have will be fixed, at least in the short term. So you know our style and our strategy throughout these times. We've expressed it many times on the podcast before. 26 years managing my own money and clients' money. And I got to tell you that I know that when you're in the thick of it, you always think that this is the worst it's ever been and this is the most volatile it's ever been and the most uncertain. But, you know, that's really not the case. Markets are volatile. What's the goal of investing? It's to put your money to work to achieve high rates of return. You can't do that if you're going to get scared in and out of markets. We've talked, of course, ad nauseum about our style and our strategy. through these kind of events. And you can see that we are only interested in upgrading the portfolio where possible, or taking advantage of opportunities in you know, maybe turning a tax loss into some kind of benefit, those kind of things, but certainly not trying to trade the macro. And even more so, the market started to recover, I think, last Monday. So the market bottomed on Monday, the last week, Monday of March. Even though the war of words, the rhetoric, continued to heighten. Right. You just don't know when the market's going to... And now the NASDAQ is up about 10% from the bottom 2 weeks ago. It's not like the news has improved. And as of last night, there was threats of nuclear war, right? So what are you supposed to do in the thick of all this craziness? Know that you own good companies. Be patient and do nothing. I mean, that's the best way that we know how to approach these things.
And it's especially important because I think once you start going down the rabbit hole and try to connect things together, mm-hmm. so you say, okay, now there's no fertilizer. Fertilizer prices are going up. So food prices are going to go up. And so is that going to lead to inflation? And then if there's inflation, is the Fed going to raise rates? And then what does that do for housing? And I think you can really invent all these scenarios that are really quite dire. And that's why I think we not to say that there's no potential of that happening, but that's why we focus on the qualitative aspects of the companies that we own to make sure that even if there is a bad, a more negative mm-hmm. outcome, the companies that we have are still going to be profitable. They're still going to be gaining market share over weaker competitors mm-hmm. and ultimately will do pretty well.
So as we approach the start of Q1 earnings report season, I think we'll be watching very carefully, listening to what companies, I mean, there might be some surprises for some companies in terms of accessing supply of some type of product right. as a result of this. Hopefully, if that's the case, it's a temporary issue. Obviously, we want to watch what's going on with the heightened oil and gas prices. And okay, I'm happy oil. I think oil at one point was down $20 a barrel today, back down to the low $90 range. But that's still a lot higher than it was 2 months ago, right? And so if it stays at this level, how's that going to impact corporate earnings going forward? And then the final thing is the AI spend.
Right.
All the headlines that we're seeing are just like, the amount of spend has just gone insane. Yet the market has glossed over it because it's completely worried about the current crisis.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's so we have to believe that there's going to be continued massive expansion for capital expenditures on AI going forward, right? No slowdown whatsoever. Andy Jassy said, he did a podcast the other day, he said, the free cash flow is going to show up at some point, but for now, it's better for us to invest.
No, and that's one of the areas where, now this is a totally separate yeah. topic from Iran, but there does seem to be a disconnect between the valuations of the AI complex, so to speak, and the rest of the market. Mm-hmm. Because, so one example is TSMC in our portfolio. Mm-hmm. TSMC is a pretty capital intensive business because they have to spend a lot of money to build these fabs to make the chips.
Billions of dollars, right. Yeah.
But TSMC literally cannot build their fabs fast enough to mm-hmm. because the demand is so high.
Elon Musk wants yeah. to build a gigantic fab.
Exactly. Yeah. And they earn very good returns on their new fabs, mm-hmm. but it trades at below market multiple relative to the S&P 500.
I would say people would argue probably the same about NVIDIA as right. well, right? So if you look at NVIDIA's P multiple today versus it was a year ago, and even TSM,
right.
exactly the same because the earnings have grown
right.
way faster than the stock price.
Meanwhile, you have... Now, they're not really comparable, but you have these kind of old school industrial companies mm-hmm. where they are good companies. Like they have a solid market share.
3M, Deere, Caterpillar, yeah. Dow.
Yeah. 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 They are profitable. They probably grow at about GDP, mm-hmm. but they trade at much higher multiples than what the TSMCs and NVIDIAs do.
Right? And they're all kind of the same thing. They're all picks and shovels, right?
Yeah. And so there is... to me, that seems like there is a disconnect in terms of what the market is assigning to these companies mm-hmm. versus what they are saying about the demand and the progress that is being made with AI.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. So let's talk about a new position. We didn't do a lot of trading in 2025, did we?
No, we didn't.
No, really the only, what was the only investment?
CoStar. We sold CoStar and we bought TSM.
Yeah.
Which was a trade for the ages.
That was a really good trade, Ernest. So I think we
did CoStar, something right.
CoStar is down like 50% since we sold it. And Taiwan Semi's up like almost a double.
Right.
Got, once in a while we get lucky. Did it, did anybody let me know that it was a great trade? No, but you and I got that inner
scorecard.
Yeah, we were very happy with that. So, no, it was not an active year for us in 2020. If you look back at, on the year, of course, number one, the tariffs, so much volatility. God knows what to do in those periods. So best just to watch it play out. The second thing, of course, was the types of stocks that we really like, the quality, growth kind of names, did not do well. And anything we would have sold on that side, we would have bought more things that didn't do well. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Right? Instead of switching for names that we never would have purchased in our portfolio.
Right.
Right. And so because they fell in valuation, but not because their fundamentals were doing poorly, we didn't want to sell.
Right.
Right. And so that's kind of, but as we have some opportunities this year, maybe with some tax loss selling, as well as maybe trimming some of our strong performers that we've taken advantage of. But finally, we bought a new position for the portfolio. It's one that we've been tracking for probably since the pandemic.
Yep.
The stock finally fell to an attractive level. Could have waited a few more weeks, but the bottom line is we bought it at what we think a level where we think we're going to generate for us and our clients a very healthy double-digit return going forward. And the company is Fair Isaac, known as FICO, F-I-C-O, on the U.S. markets. So, Ernest, you did a lot of research on the company. Why don't you give a little background on the company and why we like it?
So FICO is their main product is the FICO score, which is the number that you get when you go to get a loan application. Mm-hmm. And the FICO score is basically ubiquitous within the consumer lending industry. Mm-hmm. Almost any mortgage or auto loan or credit card that you're applying for has the FICO score underpinning the credit lending decision. So if the bank wants to decide, do I lend it to you? Do I issue you a mortgage? They're mostly relying on the FICO score.
The FICO score, FICO collects all this data about your spending history, talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the way that this works is that there are three credit bureaus, which are Equifax, TransUnion, and last one's not coming to me.
Yeah, no problem.
But those are the companies that are collecting the data about your
Experian, is that one?
Experian, yes. Yeah. Oh yeah, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, yes. So these are the companies that have the credit data on you. So like what's your track, how much debt do you have? What's your track record of falling behind on your payments? And so what FICO's job is that they would take this data, they would run it through their kind of proprietary secret sauce, mm-hmm. and then it spits out the FICO score.
Okay.
Which is then sold to the lender to make the decision. Mm-hmm. And so I think something like 98% of consumer lending decisions rely on the FICO score.
Do people have one FICO score? Or
yes.
Yeah, okay. So you get a score, you're ranked, and that tells the bank or the lender how comfortable the FICO thinks you are of repaying the loan.
Right.
And that's based upon your credit history.
Yeah.
Does FICO buy that information from the credit bureaus?
No.
Okay.
It's just run through. So the bank would pay. It's a little more complex than this, but essentially the bank would pay for the FICO score.
Yes, the bank.
And in some cases, they would pass it on to you as the borrower. In some cases, they eat the cost themselves.
Okay. So the FICO score is how they make the big bucks. They also have a software business, but that's not as material.
Yeah, that's not super important to the business as a whole.
Okay. And it's why is FICO a fabulous business?
So the reason it's a fabulous business is because it has become the standard of consumer lending. And the reason that's important is because a lot of the consumer debt that is issued mm-hmm. ends up getting securitized and sold to investors through asset-backed products, mm-hmm. such as mortgage-backed securities and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And the entire ecosystem of asset-backed consumer finance is built basically on the FICO score, where investors in these securities, the way that they determine the creditworthiness of the pool of mortgages that they're buying is based on the FICO score of the pool. Mm-hmm. And there's, in the US at least, most of the mortgages that are originated are sold to government-backed programs, mm-hmm. such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the FICO score is one of the key criteria that they look at for the mortgage to be eligible.
I think people need to understand that the loan business in the United States is gigantic. It's right. one of the biggest businesses in yep. the world, right? And so every loan that you take out, credit card, auto, mortgage, unsecured line of credit, it all needs to be rated.
Yeah.
If for those that are paying attention, you know that you have another rating agency business in your portfolio called Moody's.
Yeah.
Is FICO have elements of a Moody's type business model?
Right. Very similar, again, mm-hmm. because both Moody's and FICO, in the end, the reason that issuers are using their ratings mm-hmm. is to access lower costs of capital, right? And so that's why FICO and Moody's are kind of universally viewed as awesome businesses. Mm-hmm. No, I think FICO has leveraged their position by raising prices very aggressively mm-hmm. because there's no alternative historically to FICO.
Let me ask you a few questions. Let's get into that, because for FICO, Baskin's approach is always to own companies that have the ability to get a lot of market share,
right?
That have pricing power, that can reinvest those high returns at fast rates and grow their business into other adjacencies, for example, that are high rates of return. So with the FICO business, does that fit our Baskin strategy based upon the pricing power?
Well, absolutely, yeah, yeah. Because at the core of it, it's a asset-light business. They earn very good margins. They have pricing power, which they have very generously exercised in the past and is partially contributing to the stock price weakness.
So is
right
this
now.
Pricing power because of lack of competitors?
No, so it's, yeah. And this is a very complex, this is kind of the big debate about the stock right now, mm-hmm. which is the extent to which that they can continue to raise prices. Mm-hmm. So the reason historically that FICO has had such strong pricing power was because they were mandated by the government, right? All mortgages that had to be included in Freddie or Fannie pools had to have the FICO score. Mm-hmm. And so if you were a bank and you wanted to securitize obtain funding for mortgages through these programs, you needed to pay for the FICO score.
See, the thing that people don't understand about banks is they don't want to hold any loans on their books.
Right.
They want to sell them off as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
The banks want to be very, very asset light. Yeah. That's why banks earn great returns when times are doing well. So when the bank loans a bunch of people money through auto loans,
yeah.
it gets us off its books quickly.
If it could, yes.
If it can. And by having that FICO score, it allows it to get it off the books more quicker.
Yes.
So it's a win-win for everybody.
Right.
But as a result of that luxury, FICO's raised prices on the FICO score from what used to be a $1
yep. To $10.
To $10 now.
Yeah.
So that's 10x in pricing over a 3 or 4 year period.
Yes.
Yeah. So that has obviously raised eyebrows with a lot of commentators, of course. There's Bill Pulte, who is, the Minister of
Housing? He's the director of the FHFA,
yeah,
which
yeah.
regulates Fannie and Freddie.
Yeah, so has talked about, that FICO is taking too much price, even though it's only $10 a score.
Right.
And the bank who's paying for that $10?
No, so for those mortgages, usually the borrower pays for it in the end. It's part of the closing costs that you get when that you pay for when you buy a house.
You know, an extra $10 when you're paying thousands for real estate closings and your agent closings and moving, and it seems so trivial, but I guess it's something, it's optically moved up quickly that it catches the attention.
No, and I think there's two important points about this here. The first is that if you look at all the parties along the transaction of issuing a mortgage, none of them have the incentive to switch away from this system where FICO is the central provider of credit scores.
I laugh when you say that because you and I have been working with banks for decades, and the bank technologies, they're still using technology from 1975.
Right.
There's no incentive to, if it works, why break it?
Yeah. And I think more importantly is that what Fannie and Freddie and ultimately the FHFA, what they really care about is that the financial system does not blow up and there's a repeat of 2008, right? Because what happened in 2008 was partly due to lax underwriting standards. And as a result, Fannie and Freddie had to be bailed out by the taxpayers. And so even to the extent that FICO is raising prices a little bit too much, are you really going to risk the entire health and safety and the even the reputation of the system with investors to save borrowers $10 a mortgage?
In the meantime, FICO argued that they're coming out with a new score or improving their score that will even lead to better outcomes for consumers and for the lenders, right? And so they'll get value for the money. And the truth is they have competitive products. Some of them are even offered at zero, and the banks still won't use them.
Right, and again, it's because the bank's not paying for it. Yeah. So what do they care?
Exactly. So very interesting on FICO. Okay, so let's get into the risks and the opportunities. You know, stocks are very, very volatile. FICO is subject to the loan market. So, you know, if there's a recession or high interest rates, there could be fewer loans taken out. You know, if people default on their loans, that's not really a problem. I guess it could be.
Right.
If all their loans started to default and have to go in front of Congress saying, why was your FICO score so bad? So that's a risk, is they could screw up on that. AI, of course, people...
Just on that point, that's another reason why banks use FICO. It's because by law, banks are not allowed to discriminate on various things in terms of issuing loans. So they can't discriminate you based on your race, for instance, right?
So having a standard FICO score.
And so by having a third party standard that they can say, well, I didn't reject him because he's Asian. I rejected him because his FICO score was low, right? And so that helps banks to comply with regulation.
Beautiful.
And is one and another aspect that of their business.
Okay, so FICO is always traded at a premium valuation. Actually, it didn't. It didn't until interest rates really fell dramatically. Right. And all of a sudden there was, I guess during the pandemic, there was a boom for refinancing and a boom for loans. That got destroyed after interest rates went up in 2022. And pretty much, although FICO stock has done well, it's given up a lot of those gains recently. Now there's potential for, if things calm down in the world, the U.S. wants to cut interest rates. We all know that.
Yes.
That could be a catalyst. But the bottom line is, you know, what are the opportunities for FICO? And then I'll ask again about the risks.
So partly residential housing volumes have been quite weak.
Okay.
Partly because of higher interest rates and the fact that a lot of borrowers who bought houses and got mortgages, and when interest rates were 1 or 2%, they're essentially stuck at their houses and not really able to move. Mm-hmm. So that has been that's impacted FICO's volumes. And so part of our hope is that we are buying the stock at a somewhat depressed part of the business cycle relative to where interest rates are.
So what people need to understand is, although interest rates have come down a lot from 2022, 2023, interest rates on the long end of the curve,
yeah,
which determine mortgage rates in the U.S., have not come down enough to make it worthwhile to sell your house and buy another house.
Right.
And, you know, right now with the world in where it is, it's a slow market. There are pockets of hot areas in all real estate markets, but we all know there's lots of pockets, especially in Ontario, of cool areas.
Yes.
So it's until interest rates come down meaningful or animal spirits pick up, it's hard to see, an acceleration in loan activity.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
We'll see.
Yeah.
None of us know. Things change on a dime.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have that as an opportunity. What else is FICO doing to try and grow? We know it raised its pricing. We know it's arguing that it's adding better value. So, but what else can it do to increase results going forward aside from...
Well, I think a lot of it is just whether their pricing power remains intact. Mm-hmm. No, I think there's been a lot of kind of chatter about competition from a competing product called Vantage Score, mm-hmm, and whether that could... the FHFA is currently approving Vantage Score as an alternative use for mortgage-backed securities, mm-hmm, right? So I think there's been some questions about their pricing power going forward with a lower-priced alternative on the side.
And that's why FICO no longer trades at $2,500 a share.
Right.
That's why it's trading around, $1,100, $1,300, $1,400 a share. That worry is now priced into the market.
No, I think it'll be, there's a very, just because you're allowed to, doesn't mean that it will happen. Mm-hmm. I think there's a few reasons to be skeptical about Vantage Score taking meaningful market share. Mm-hmm. The most important one being that most of the banks are still, their systems have been built around FICO Score. Mm-hmm. And so to introduce a new score, you would have to revamp your entire loan origination systems, mm-hmm, which I don't think most banks want to do, especially since they're passing the score price on to the customers.
Given the pullback recently in software and some data providing and infotech companies, we've all seen those types of names, the Visas, the Moody's, the software names, and FICO, they've all pulled back in terms of evaluation.
Is there
any impact of AI on their business? Is the pullback just due to the uncertainty of the market, or is there any like?
No, so yeah. No, so I don't think that, no, again, like it's not that hard to create a model that can spit out a score, mm-hmm, and be reasonably accurate at predicting a person's creditworthiness. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the challenge is that FICO has been tested through the financial crisis, mm-hmm, which is something that no new model can really say that. Like, let's say you and I developed a new model today, mm-hmm, and we back tested it and said, okay, look, it outperforms FICO even through the financial crisis.
Yeah.
The risk is that we over optimized the model, mm-hmm, to outperform based on the economic situations that happened in the past. Mm-hmm. And so that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to outperform going forward. You just created a model that works well for yesterday,
yeah,
right? And so I think more importantly is that once you, and we'll see how this plays out, but now that there is, you can choose between Vantage and FICO, mm-hmm, there is the possibility of gaming the system, mm-hmm, right? Because
excuse me,
I think what the bank wants is they want to approve the mortgage. Mm-hmm. Now, if there's a borrower that comes in, you're going to want to choose the looser standard,
okay,
right?
Okay.
Because it approves them for a larger loan size and higher chance of approval. Mm. And so what does that do to the entire securitized market when people are kind of choosing for the laxer score? I think that has been something that Fannie has been aware of and why they recommended that we stick with a single score model.
Sorry, I'm dying here. Yeah,
single score system, yeah, right? And so I think we'll have to see how all these things play out. But long story short, I don't think their business model is really changed. And again, like in the case of Moody's and S&P, even if there's two products, it doesn't mean that I think FICO will still do fine.
I'm not sure I'm going to do fine. I'm coughing my brains. Maybe we'll just end it there on the FICO.
Good.
But anything else you want to say about FICOs that you want to cover that you think our clients who now own the stock right. should know?
No, I think that what we talked about, I don't think it's new. Like that was all the like the pricing power, their strong market share. I think all of that stuff was why the stock traded at 80 times earnings at mm-hmm. the peak, mm-hmm. right? And so this is, we didn't pull the plug then, but now the valuation is much more reasonable. We think it takes into account the risks that we talked about, and that's why we bought the stock.
That's all we have for you because I can't talk anymore. We'll see you back here real soon.
This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.